Hello, welcome back. My name is Dwayne Orr, and I'm chief engineer at NASA's Columbia Scientific Balloon Facility in Palestine, Texas. And by the way, you're going to see a balloon launch here. Not a lot of people have seen that, so you're going to get to see that coming up. But last time we talked about dinosaurs in the Bible, and I hope you've had a chance to take a look at that and see the power of God's creation in his creatures and what that means, and the fact that they found soft tissue in dinosaur bone, which just, you know, which tells us they really don't know how, I mean, I'm not telling you how old those bones are. I'm just telling you they don't know. That's what the point I'm making. So, but today, we're going to go through and talk about more different areas of science, star formation, the origins of the universe, some biology stuff, even climate change. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So I call this one Creation Science, the Evidence, or What Mainstream Science Does Not Tell You. And so you can see my downlink there. You can go to lifeword.org and downlink these presentations and my email address if you're interested in taking a look at that. But I like to point out, John Lennox, and I quote this several times, it is the science I do understand that makes sense. That's something I can put my brain around that points me toward God. Not the science I don't understand. Not the science where they bring up quirky, you know, calculus mathematics that they're trying to prove multiverses and things like that. And you can prove that with mathematics. It's just that no evidence of it exists. So it's the science that I do understand, that I can comprehend, that really points me toward God. But to begin with here, I'm going to show you a balloon launch, and I hope you enjoy this. So this is a balloon, one of our payloads in Sweden. You can see this bubble here. It's an upside down teardrop shape. And we launch these balloons all over the world, Antarctica, Australia, New Zealand, even in Alaska, other places. And you can tell it's a large system. That whole system from the top of that balloon down to where a payload is, a small, tiny payload, that's about 1,000 feet. And this balloon's going to go up about 25 miles, about 130,000 feet. And he's going to look at the expansion rate of the universe. We're going to talk about that shortly. But these are great mechanisms for scientists to get the science, really high-quality science, on a vehicle that's a lot less expensive than a rocket or a satellite. And so the government does this. The government does these kind of science research in the areas of origins of the universe, or are stars forming, or are cosmic rays bothering you. There's no money in that science, so that's the kind of science NASA and the government will fund. But here you have this launch, that's about a 6,000 pound payload, and he's about to release it, and it's gonna float into the upper atmosphere. And it's really a majestic thing, and a really cool thing to do. But yeah, the winds have got to be really light to do this, and so we have to go to places and wait a long time. We have to watch the wind blow and things like that, but it's a pretty exciting field. I've enjoyed it, and there, you got to see a balloon launch. So I like to point out where I get a lot of my resources, a lot of information, Institute of Creation Research out of Dallas, Texas, ICR.org, PhD-level scientists doing research, high-level research that points toward God, and you can get their Acts and Facts magazine. It's a very thin magazine. If you start reading that, you'll start putting some of this stuff together, but it's really powerful, and they do a great job there for the honor and glory of God, and I just love those guys. But I want to make the point. Science is not a democracy. It's a dictatorship, and consensus is not science. When you ever hear about a scientific consensus, that's not science. They have a right to have an opinion. They have a right to discuss what they really believe it is, but there's no evidence with that, just a consensus. So always when you see, hey, the scientific consensus is this, let the little light bulb go off in your brain, go, well, that's just their opinion now. So keep that in mind. So this slide talks about evidence. What evidence do we have of a young universe? And I get this from ICR. And so you can see on the top right, the little graph there, it shows the spiral galaxies. And we see that winding up of spiral galaxies and short-lived blue stars and neutron stars, which within global clusters, all indicate the universe is much younger than claimed by secular science. You know, the top right, the spiral galaxy, should not exist after 5 billion years. I'm not saying it's 5 billion years, but they shouldn't be around if it's if the universe is 14.8 billion years old. Also, the globular clusters there, you see blue stars there in the middle one. Those should not exist after 15 million years. That's the kind of evidence that they show, but they don't share that with you. So why are they still here if the universe is that old? Also, the bottom right, these clusters around around these center points there, those shouldn't be there anyway. And I'd like to point out this. This was an astronomer, John Eddy, back in 1978, said, "Note, I suspect that the sun is 4.5 billion years old. However, given some new and unexpected results to the contrary, and some time for frantic recalculation and theoretical readjustment, I suspect that we could live with Bishop Usher's value, about 6,000 years, for the age of the Earth and the sun. I don't think we have much in the way of observational evidence in astronomy to conflict with that." Well, there's an honest answer. And we're going to talk about how they come up with some of that as we go on. What about evidence of the young Earth? Here's some powerful things. And we broached some of this during the dinosaurs in the Bible. But radiocarbon, carbon-14 in old specimens. Every living creature, every living thing has radiocarbon in it when it dies. Its store of radiocarbon begins decreasing. When it dies, it starts diminishing. And we get this in plants and animals and everything. And because radiocarbon decays relatively quickly, fossils that are even 100,000 years old should have virtually no radiocarbon left in them, but they do. The radiocarbon atom's half-life is 5,820 years. And so if you do the math, even by 50,000 years, you probably can't see it. Even with our microscopes, our nanotechnology, you couldn't see it. And it should be gone by 100,000 years. But get this. Radiocarbon is consistently found in coal, oil, natural gas, dinosaur bones, which are said to be millions of years old. As a matter of fact, I've never heard of an incident where they've looked at a bone or something, a fossilized plant, and not found carbon. It should be there. It shouldn't be there, but it is. Again, I'm not telling you how old it is. I'm just telling you they don't know, okay? How about transition fossils? They're non-existent. And although the transition from ape-like fossils to human fossils is usually thought of as a momentous transformation, the fossil record bearing on the origin and the earliest evolution of humans is virtually undocumented. There's nothing there. And a quote from the 2016 Royal Society paper, "The transition that wasn't." They just can't find the evidence of this. Again, fossils are formed by being buried under high-pressure flood or something like that. They had to be put under pressure in the right conditions. Water and flood do that. Anything that dies on the surface of the earth is going to be eaten, carried off, and it's not going to remain. So the only way we have fossils is something that buried them very quickly. Floods form fossils fast. ICR likes to talk about that a lot, and they're spot on. Also, we see evidence of a rainforest in Antarctica. I've actually been there. We launched our balloons from down there. Not seen this evidence, by the way. But scientists discovered evidence of ancient rainforests in Antarctica, similar to the kind of climate you would see in New Zealand, at 45 degrees latitude. It supports this Pangaea-like supercontinent before the flood. And we see that. So it's pretty cool that you can find those kind of fossilized plants and trees in Antarctica that don't grow there now. Nothing grows there now. But it's evidence that there was something different back then. And it's powerful to see God's word is true in that. Also, I'd like to point out that, you know, we always think that Cro-Magnon, we get fossils like this, but those traits are evidence in humanity now. Prominent brow ridges, sloping foreheads, small craniums are still to be found in living human beings. And you can see that the picture right there below, that living people are walking around like that, and it's nothing that's out of the ordinary. It's just something we don't see every day. Also, I like to point out, what does the fossil record show? Okay? It shows a sudden appearance of basic types complete with all features which characterize them. Very detailed, very complex, it's there. Basic types show stasis. Feature stasis as a dominant trend. It does not make major changes. You'll see small changes, but not major changes. Complexity at the start, that's pretty fascinating. From the very first time a fossil type or plant or animal appears, it shows all the design features that make it special. We don't see these transitions in there. But we do see extinction, but not evolution. Evolution requires a dizzying array of basic new kinds. The origination of new form has never been documented in the modern world of scientific observation. Just never been. Fossils found in catastrophic deposits with indications of violent death, that's the way we find fossils. Fossilized animals give every indication they were violently killed and or transported to the places we now find them. I showed this last week, and I like this. They have a replica of a very famous fossil pair called the Fighting Dinosaurs. That's on the lower bottom. That's out at the ICR Discovery Center, Museum in Las Colinas. You should go there sometime. It's powerful. They do a great job. But that's the way these things died. They were fighting. You know, it's not going to die over a long period of time. This is quick, and it's a powerful evidence of a catastrophic event that showed up. Also, you see some fossilized remains at the Creation Evidence Museum in Glen Rose, Texas. That's down there. You can walk down to the riverbank. You can see those dinosaur prints in the riverbed, and then they even have some of these evidence. That's an actual cutout of a riverbed. Shows a man's footprint with a dinosaur. How about that? Mainstream science does not like to talk about that. Issues with global warming. I'm all for taking care of our planet. I think God wants us to be responsible for it. And so I think it's a good thing. But, you know, one of the things I find is I like to point out about global warming is that in 1990, the IPCC chart, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they had a little chart and they showed the medieval warming period in the 1300s. But in 2001, that disappears on the chart on the right. And I'd like to let everybody know this personal observation. Archaeology has shown that the Vikings farmed in Greenland prior to the Little Ice Age, which began in the late 1300s. I don't believe the earth is warmed enough for us to farm there now. We're not farming up there, but you can see this. In fact, you can go on YouTube. You can type in Little Ice Age. A history channel did a documentary on this. And they'll show you evidence of the Vikings farming and ranching in Greenland. But what happened was a little mini ice age came in, drove everybody away from places that they couldn't grow anything, couldn't make food anymore. And they drove them into towns and cities. And before long, the Black Plague started. And so the thing I like to point out is global warming is not necessarily as bad as global freezing. Global freezing, you can't grow food. You can't do a lot of those kind of things, and we never talk about that. Again, I think we should take care of our planet, but in the 1300s, there was no carbon emission to make the world warmer. It was just done naturally. So I'd just like to point those things out. There's questions we can ask. The biggest problem is, in our society, what we're doing is we're saying, we can control this. We can change this environment. We can change the climate by these little things we do. We're looking at God and we don't need you, God. We can take care of this. And that's the big lie. That's what Satan wants us to think, is that we don't need God. We can solve all these problems. And there's really no evidence we understand what's causing this, and no strong evidence that humans are causing it. It's just intuitive. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I can't blame them. The climate's changing, but there's no hard evidence that human interaction is the main thing doing that. So just thought I'd bring that up. Next slide. Darwin's black box. Evolutionary theory teaches that bacteria were one of the first forms of life to evolve, and therefore they are simple. While bacteria are small, they are not simple. They can even communicate among themselves using chemicals. Some plants have motors that are one-fifth the size of bacterial motors, increasing worldwide interest in nanotechnology. This small stuff where we get these powerful telescopes can look at really small things is showing that living things are remarkably designed. beyond anything Darwin could have imagined. These motors they've found in, you know, last 10, 20 years and recognize these things. They don't even understand what they do. But 8 million of these bacterial motors would fit inside the circular cross-section of a human hair. Wow. Now, that's a powerful God that can design and make something like that work. And our understanding of it is just basic. And so sometimes we just miss the boat in understanding how powerful God's creation is. So, next I want to show you some videos from a gentleman named Dr. Berlinski. And I hope you enjoy these. He's going to talk about Evan a lot of different things about evolutionary science and his understanding of it. They call him incorrigible. You're going to see that he's not a Christian. I'm not sure if he's an atheist or agnostic or whatever it may be, but he'll tell you his thoughts on evolution. Hope you enjoy it.
With the other postdoctoral fellows, people who were working in the laboratory at the time, and I discovered, somewhat to my own surprise, that the arguments, which seemed so very credible, very important, went virtually unanswered among the biologists that I knew, who tended to dismiss the arguments in a way that suggested that they hadn't really understood them, and if they had understood them, were not prepared to respond to them. And that was the beginning of my skepticism about Darwinian theory. Well, the claim that all skeptics about Darwinian orthodoxy or Christian fundamentalists stands refuted by me. It's obviously not true. I'm neither Christian nor a fundamentalist. But lots and lots of people are skeptical in the scientific community. I know dozens of mathematicians who scratch their head and say, you guys think this is the way life originated? It's absolutely a preposterous theory. And many, many very significant figures. John von Neumann, one of the great mathematicians of the 20th century, just laughed at Darwinian theory. He hooted at it. The people who are actively engaged in research take it for granted because the political penalties of questioning it are very high. And there's a very natural suspicion among, say, a molecular biologist that the experts have gone and figured it out in another discipline. This doesn't happen to be true, but there is a very natural suspicion. So the political price to questioning Darwinian theories is high, the incentive is low, and that's the natural result, that the community is relatively phlegmatic. But still, there are some talented biologists at work who are not entirely satisfied with the reigning paradigms. Look, even Crick, even Francis Crick, who with Watson discovered the structure of DNA, when he started to think about the origins of life from chemical constituents, he just threw up his hands after a while and said the cumulative improbabilities are so staggering that in all likelihood life was sent here from outer space. He's right. I mean, that's a better explanation than anything we've got. It's tough to say because we're not dealing with a theory in any sense in which, say, a physicist would recognize the theory. We're dealing with a collection of anecdotes, a certain point of view, a series of hunches. I would say that the most outstanding, the salient points are, first of all, the fossil record, which is simply mystifying. We can't make much sense of the fossil record. It does not sustain any kind of Darwinian prediction that can be intelligently derived from Darwinian theory, and it doesn't seem to sustain anything else as far as I can see. It's a perfectly mystifying record. That's one obvious point. I'm not talking just about the Cambrian explosion. I'm talking about everything that doesn't make a whole lot of sense in the fossil record. Second point, we have never been able in any way theoretically to examine the central Darwinian claim that natural selection and random variation can account for a great deal of complexity. If you look at the history of physics, for example, what did Newton do in the 17th century? He said, well, the planets are being attracted to the sun by a force. It's not any kind of force. It's a inverse square force. And then he went and showed that if you make that assumption, the result will be an orbit that conforms exactly to the observed orbit, say, of the Earth or of Mars. It will be a conic section. And then he proved the converse, that if it's a conic section, the planets must be attracted to a central source by an inverse square law. There is nothing like that in biology, in Darwinian theory. A kind of a canonical demonstration that this mechanism, random variation, natural selection, is adequate to the generation of this level of complexity. From the point of view of the serious sciences, without that kind of a demonstration, one is completely adrift. You have no idea whether the mechanism is adequate for its intended purposes. This is the second point. Third evidential piece of the puzzle. Look, you turn to the serious sciences, you turn to general relativity or quantum mechanics. I can program a computer with the equations of general relativity or with the equations of quantum mechanics, and I can say, all right, what are the consequences? I can actually see the consequences emerge in a simulation. We can't do any of this in biology. And that should prompt any reasonable person to ask, why not? If this is such a simple mechanism, which could easily be programmed on a computer, how come we can't set up a computer and create something of biological-like complexity? How come we cannot see the unfolding of an evolutionary process the way we can see the unfolding of an evolutionary process in physics? This is a very serious question. I've looked at all the genetic algorithms. I'm trying to write a genetic algorithm myself. And the sheer fact is, without a tremendous amount of very special manipulation and ad hoc constraints, the computer is not going to generate anything realistic if it uses Darwinian mechanisms, and it will generate something realistic only if it doesn't use Darwinian mechanisms. This is an important point. 50 years after the computer revolution began, we have a splendid tool for assessing the intelligibility and viability of Darwinian theory. And everything that we know, and I think this is the uniform experience of anyone working in genetic algorithms, indicates these mechanisms will not work. They will not work for their intended purposes. And finally, there's the utter absence of laboratory evidence. I mean, random variation, natural selection, we should be able to start manipulating organisms. When we look at dogs, no matter how far back we go, it's dogs. When we look at bacteria, no matter what we do, they stay bugs. They don't change in their fundamental nature. There seems to be some sort of an inherent species limitation, and we have no good explanation for this in terms of Darwinian theory. We should have far more flexibility, far more plasticity under laboratory conditions than we actually do if Darwinian theory or anything like that were correct. What we see in nature, what we see in the laboratory, is very highly bounded variation, cyclic variation, as for example, finch beaks in the Galapagos Island. That's about all we see. Small variations. Why is that if Darwinian theory is correct? These are evidentiary points that I think need to be stressed, need to be examined openly, honestly. And they never are, of course. Never are. One of the reasons that people embrace Darwinian orthodoxy with such an unholy zealousness is just that it gives them access to power. It's as simple as that. Power over education, power over political decisions, power over funding, and power over the media. No one in a society which is openly contemptuous of religious expression in any form wants to be identified with the side at which the intellectuals and the leaders of taste and opinion are going to snicker. This, again, is human nature. We would not expect the philosopher to be boisterous in his denunciation of Darwinian theory if it could cause people at the faculty club to whisper about him. And that's exactly what we find. Tremendous amount of pressure in this society or any other to conform to socially accepted beliefs, strategies of evidence appraisal and the like. Well, the idea that the scientific enterprise is governed by a majority of opinion, it's not entirely a foolish idea. I mean, we can't get rid of it completely and say that the truth is so unassailable that it can be discovered by one individual, inevitably running against the tide of every other individual. There has to be some consensus and some points of view of science. And to suggest that the fact that so many biologists are willing publicly to endorse Darwinian theory is of no account is foolish. To a certain extent, I do agree with that. It is important to present within an educational establishment what is the standard, the mainstream, the canonical view. There's no question about that. But at the same time, for heaven's sake, let's open up the discussion a little bit and present some countervailing views, at least to the extent of appraising Darwinian theory in the context that realistically portrays it for what it is. A kind of amusing 19th century collection of anecdotes that is utterly unlike anything we see in the serious sciences. That would be my favorite position. Biologists do agree that this is the correct theory for the origin and diversification of life, but here are some points you should consider as well. One, the theory doesn't have any substance. Two, it's preposterous. Three, it's not supported by the evidence. And four, the fact that the biologists are uniformly in agreement about this issue could as well be explained by some solid Marxist interpretation of their economic interests. That would satisfy me. It's not asking for much, is it?
So we're going to stop right there today. Next time, we're going to look at issues with distances to stars, how they come up with that, what they're talking about, star formation. We're also going to look at what dark matter is about and origins of the universe discussion. So I hope you join us. But you can tell right here, there's a lot of evidence, a lot of logic that puts evolution into question, particularly the more we know about it, the less it makes sense. Lord bless you. We'll see you next week.